Welcome to Aircrew Interview. I'm Mike, your host, and this is another one of our live Q&A sessions we hold via our YouTube channel, which gives a chance for our viewers to ask previous guests anything on their flying career. This episode, we chat with Phil Keeble, who flew the Canberra F4 and Tornado F3. If you like what we do here over at Aircrew Interview and would like to support us and help us grow, you can head over to our Patreon channel at patreon.com/aircrewinterview, where you can donate monthly. We have different tiers ranging from $1 per month right up to $25, with each tier offering different rewards. All the monthly donations greatly help us to continue creating these video and audio interviews, so please take a look and I thank you in advance. Enjoy.
What have I been up to? I've been writing, obviously. not much more than that, to be honest, at the moment. I've had a bad chest and that's not been very clever, and so that stopped me doing a lot of outside stuff. Although I did chop down a tree today and yesterday and the day before and Sunday. So I'm feeling better, obviously. So I've got Aircrew Interview, Get Your Questions coming in. I can't see any yet. But book-wise, the first book is selling reasonably well, which was the, I've got it here, Patrolling the Cold War Skies. Everybody wants to see it. And that's done reasonably well. I mean, I'm never going to be a John Grisham or a Bernard Cornwell or anybody like that, but that's been good. Dave Gledhill and I, let me find it, then went on to do the second book, which is called Per Adua, and that is training a RAF Phantom crew. Now, we've written this together for obvious reasons, because, well, obviously, a crew is a crew, navigator and pilot. So we've been writing that. While it's up, I'll just show you that if people want a copy, and now's a good time, actually, because the publishers, Font Hill Media, look at their website, are offering it for £20 with free postage. Now, that's a cracking deal. And Dave and I would have a struggle equaling that at the moment, especially with postage being what it is. But there you go. That's the adverts. And now I'm waiting for the questions. One from Lockie Lock. Thank you, Lockie Lock, whoever you are. Enjoyed your initial interview. Yes, I enjoyed it. I always like talking to people that like airplanes. There's something generally wholesome about them. And you can talk about things like that without any politics or any other niff-naff. So come on, boys. Let's put a question in. I enjoyed the interview, and I've seen some of the feedback from it. Caused a fair degree of controversy, which is good. A bit of controversy doesn't do you any harm. when we were programmed to go against the F-14, the weapons instructor said, boys, we're going to get our asses kicked. Simple as that. So we've got to come up with better tactics. Otherwise, we ain't going to win. You know, any scenario, combat scenario, has rules. You have an area rule, which you're not allowed to go out. You have a height rule, top and bottom, which you're not allowed to go above or below. And there may be other rules, like if you're over land, you may have a speed rule, things like that. We were over the Mediterranean off the coast of Cyprus, and therefore the rules were very few and far between. So we had a big play area. An American battle aircraft carrier had come into the Med, gave us a ring and said, do you boys want to play and fight? And we said, yeah, of course we do. We could learn a lot from you. They said, all right, then, this is we'll be at this point, this time, this day, meet us head on. You come from the west, we'll come from the east, game on. And then we go through the rules of combat. What's a kill, what's not a kill, when you knock it off, fuel, emergencies, frequencies. Oh, half an hour of instant briefing before you fly. And then maybe an hour of pre-briefing just to get your act together and, you know, I was going to be rude then and say, get all your shit in one sock, which is a phrase we use. But you know what I mean. And so the QI was a young QI, Fred, and he came up with a tactic. He said, we're going to sandwich them. So instead of coming in from pure west, one will come in from slightly north of west and one will come in slightly south of west. And whoever they come towards, the other one can hook in around behind them. Well, the first time that happened, it didn't work very well. We had the standard sort of 5 to 10 mile split between the pair elements, and they polished us off. They also cheated because they used the what do you call it, the big missile. Oh, it's gone. Maverick. No, not Maverick. What's it called? You'll know.
Phoenix.
Phoenix. That's the one. Thanks, Mike. Phoenix. So we were on a hiding to nothing. So the second sortie, we said, look, guys, the Phoenix, we might as well stay on the ground. Then you have Phoenix fired at us because we ain't going to win. So how about we don't count the Phoenix and we'll go sort of a little bit more equal. Sidewinder against Sidewinder and Sparrow against Skyflash. They went, yeah, fine. What we also did was widen the split out to more than 10 miles. And, of course, that now baffled them. So they couldn't kill us at long range, so they had to stay and fight. So that was great fun. Great fun. On another occasion, we came in even wider. They came in about 10 plus, and we came in about 20 plus apart. And that gave us the same advantage. On a third occasion, we went in with Hawks. Now, this was really good. We towed the Hawks in with us on our wing to about 6 miles. And then once we saw the enemy and the Hawks saw the enemy, we directed them onto it. We then plugged the burners in, accelerated to beyond the Mach, and buggered off over the horizon very bravely. The Hawks then stayed and fought against the F-18s and F-14s, whatever was there. And, of course, the Hawk is a very, very nimble aircraft. So they stayed and fought, tied them up. We then turned round and came chasing back and locked up whatever we saw in our radar. In the HUD, you get the little HUD symbol, and you can look through that and see. And if it was big, it was an American. If it was tiny, it was one of ours. So we didn't shoot the tiny ones. We shot the big ones and claimed them. And at the end of the day, we did very well because purely because of tactics, no other reason, because of tactics. The aircraft wasn't better. There was no shadow of a doubt about that. And throughout history, if you read about the Israelis and the Arabs and many of the other wars, look at Pakistan and India today. It's the better tactics or the better pilots that actually have advantage over the slightly more advantageous airplane. But having said that, I mean, of course, now the Eurofighter has got much cleverer and bigger missiles than ever before. Anyway, look, there's hundreds of questions coming in. Let me have a quick look. There was a couple I missed a little bit earlier. Do you think a re-engined F4 with upgraded avionics could have stayed relevant longer? Definitely. Absolutely, definitely. No shadow of a doubt about it. Because when the Tornado came in, dare I say it, excuse me, it was a disaster. Absolute disaster. The radar was non-existent. And so we went through this extended period of waiting for radars to arrive that worked, which didn't for a long time. It got itself a bad reputation, which it didn't really deserve, apart from the radar. And so had we had a modified F4, we could have gone on for another, easily 3 or 4 years, whilst the Tornado F3 ADV was actually upgraded and made the radar to work. So the F2 came in, I flew it. It was a lovely airplane to fly, within reason. It's no pocket rocket, but it's good enough. But then if we waited for the F3, then there was a number of stages that came in, X stage, Y stage, Z stage, and then other modifications. And by the time the Tornado finished our service, I think it was doing a super job. It had the stuff which people neglect to really have a look at because everyone's dismissed it. But it had data link. Now, Tornado with data link, link 16 or wherever it was, is brilliant. You can see where everybody is, every player is of your own, and every target that every player has got on their screen. And you can therefore, you can just make a game plan and go for it. And that gives you the advantage. It was never an aircraft to knife fight in a phone box. It wasn't a great turner or burner. But what it was very fast with very good missiles. The Skyflash was stunning. And with a decent radar, which it had towards the end, I think it was a phase 2 radar, and all the different modifications that went in, yes, it was a good aircraft. And that's the gap that the Phantom should have covered. The Air Force has got this terrible thing. This one is to John Ellis, by the way, John, if you're wondering who asked it, you did. The Air Force has always got this thing of getting rid of an aircraft right at its peak, right at its perfection. In other words, it's been in 10, 20, 30 years, 40 years, in, like with a camera, and they go, right, time to have something new and fancy. And often something new and fancy doesn't hold a light to what it's replacing. So if you take the Hunter, the FGA-9s, the 10s, the Recce 11s and 12s and so on, that brilliant aircraft, and they could have stayed on as ground attack and tactical recce. You've got aircraft like the Buccaneer was very good towards the end with the Sea Eagles. The Lightning, the 6s, had a bit more fuel, and it was perfectly capable of staying in service a bit longer. And I think a lot of air forces are very good at putting up numbers. You go against the Russians, and they're going to put up a swarm. I remember one exercise we went against 150 Americans. Now, that is impossible to defeat. There's just too many. They just overwhelm you. They swamp you. Whereas we might put up, say, 50 or 60 or 70. That's not enough. You know, if you're going to go to war, fine in peacetime for keeping the peace, fine in small insurgencies or small wars, like the Falklands or maybe even, you know, the Gulf and things like that. But if you want to go up against a big air force, like, dare I say it, the Russians or the Chinese or even the Americans, then you're screwed. Let me just go with another one. Did I fly from Liming? Not fighters, no. I flew from Liming I went there to do a course on Jet Provost. Loved it. Great pubs. The beautiful countryside. Love Liming. Wanted a tour there. Wanted a tour in Germany. Never got either. Most of the time I spent in Scotland or Lincolnshire, certainly on the fighters. And that's from Steve Hindmarsh. Oh, the freckle punny, whatever that means. Should the 14 or 15 be bought by the RAF rather than the Tornado F3? Oh, what a question. Yes, F-15s, 10 out of 10, 1,000 out of 1,000, that's the aircraft we should have bought. I sat in one, I didn't fly, I flew the 16, which was lovely, a little bit small, but the 15, big, chunky. You could tell it was the big brother to the F-4. Everything was in the same position, everything was perfect. And even now, even the other day, well, you saw it, that flypast in Sheffield, the F-15 still looked the business. Brilliant aircraft. The 14, not so much for us, I don't think. I know Mike's a favourite of the 14. It looks cool. But I think if you want to go into Europe and, you know, have a good fight, then the 15 is one of the most capable. And it's probably my favourite aircraft that I never flew. Training rules of engagement in Top Gun terms. Right, rules of engagement are basically safety rules. That's what they amount to. And not only safety rules, but game rules. When is a shot valid? When is a shot not valid? What do you do if you get killed? Do you leave the fight? Don't come back, or do you leave the fight and come back 5 minutes later, whatever? Safety rules, you normally had pre-merge 1,000 feet of height separation so you didn't run into one another, and then you briefed us who was even heights and who was odd heights. And then once you were visual, you have to have tally or visual with everybody in the fight to make sure that nobody's going to run into one another. And of course, that doesn't always happen. It has happened in the past. People have smacked one another. I've got friends who rejected having done that. But you normally have a 1,000-foot bubble in the nose, which you do not burst. He says, with a huge degree of hypocrisy. And then round the back, you have a 500-foot bubble, which you do not burst. And those are the basic rules of engagement peacetime. Wartime rules of engagement are completely different. Those 1,000-foot bubbles don't exist. The sort of the rules we had down the Falklands were a singleton, medium level, slow, got to be identified. Now, if it was low and fast, or a pair and fast, or rules like that, you could shoot. If it came inside the protection zone, you could shoot it and then ask questions afterwards. Because, to be perfectly honest, if you pansy around and you don't take your shot soon, and he is aggressive, he's going to have you before you have him. We also had the rule, which is, I'm sure, was a solicitor's or a idea, was called the golden rule of self-defense. If ever you're attacked, you're allowed to re-attack. Well, yeah, that's a difficult one if you're not sure who you're going against. Has he attacked me earlier or not? I don't know. That's one that they'll fight out, the legal beagles will fight out in court. Talking of breaking the rules, there was one thing that I got shown on one of my very earliest Phantom Squadron combat trips, and that's the Mexican dust-off. Now, the Mexican dust-off ignores all the rules. You aim at the opposition, you go as fast as you can, and you try to go as close as you can. If you can get a shockwave about 20, 30 feet, or maybe probably a little bit higher, above his canopy, it will stun him, or the pilot and the crew. And by the time they've come, what the hell was that? Then you're turning around the back, ready for the kill. Well, the first time it happened to me, I sat there and thought, what the bloody hell was that? So afterwards, I thought, well, that's a good tactic. And I must confess, I did use it on occasions if I was after a particularly unruly enemy that I thought might take advantage of me. And so you fly across the top as fast as you can. And then while he's still flying straight and level, working out whether he needs to change his underpants or not, you're coming around the back going, daka, 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 or whatever. Anyway, Ian Mangum, I see a camera on the wall over my left shoulder. I've got to be careful here now, because this thing's back to front. If it's the one over there, that's a PR9 in Malta. Do you know? That's the only one I've got. How remiss of me. One of our corporals painted that for me. And I did my first tour in Malta, which, to be honest, you couldn't wish for a better tour. Oh, I mean, our remit was to fly around the world, all over the place, from Kenya, the Far East, Singapore, Hong Kong, obviously a lot in North Africa. And then where else did we go? I can't remember now. Long time ago. All around the Med, all around Europe. And obviously, we had a war role. Otherwise, there's no point being there. And our war role was to fly into southern Russia and do whatever we did to see what was going on there. So, I was young. I was 21. I was out there. I was newly married, in the sun. We were poor because if you were under 25, you didn't get any allowances, which meant that we had to scrape it together. But I promise you, there are worse places than that. There is a Canberra PR9. Now, the PR9, we were talking about last developments of the Air Force. The PR9 was unbelievable, stunning aircraft to fly. It had more power than you knew what to do with, so much power that if you lost one engine on takeoff, you throttled the other one back from 100% to 90% because of the torque, the asymmetric twist that the engine would produce, and it would flip you on your back, which has happened, sadly. It would go up to well above 50. It was fast. It would do 550 knots without even blinking an eyelid. And so what we used to do, we used to go off on NATO exercises, and we were often what they call the directing staff, DS staff. We would go out in the morning, take the pictures, come back, and then the other crews, the Phantoms, the Jaguars, whoever, the G91s would all go out and take theirs and see if they got the same targets. What we used to do, I used to lurk around at what we call initial point, which may be 10 miles away from the airfield. You call initials and then it feeds everybody in for a visual circuit. So I used to wait for the Phantoms to call initial point and they'd come cruising in as a pair or a foreship at about 420 knots. Then I used to dart down behind them, accelerate to about 550. And then about 3 miles from the airfield, I used to rush ahead of them and call the brake ahead of them and land before them. Because by the time they realized what was happening, it was too late. This Canberra was doing 130 knots faster and no way they were going to put the burner in and catch us. So that was just a bit of fun that we used to do. But the PR9, I mean, I do know from guys who were in places that were a little bit dodgy, used to go faster than that. And they would run away with their tails bravely between their legs because we're unarmed, of course. And speed or height, or if you got caught, then turning. You could outturn almost anything except a Vulcan at height. The Vulcan was superb. And so I fought Lightnings. And I mean, I used to, any bit of combat I would take up. And I can remember doing a sortie against two Lightnings. And I wasn't in a 9, I was in a 7, the older one, the slightly smaller engines. And we actually managed to shoot a couple of Lightnings down, to our credit. But there we are. Lucky Lock, A50, aim 54 feet. Yes, I know, I've written about it. And I forgot. I'm getting old now, Lockie Lock. Please forgive me. I don't remember as much as I do. How do you know if simulated missiles hit or not? That's from Smedley Do-Right. Okay. In the early days, you had ACMI, Air Combat Maneuvering Instrumentation Area, which there was one initially off Sardinia coast, where we used to go, to Tetu Mamano, Italian Air Force Base. And all that was data linked through beacons on the water, buoys, which were then relayed back to a central computer, which would store it all. And then when we landed, we would watch it in video form. Well, not video form, graphic form. And you could see who shot who when and what was a kill, what was a not kill. At the same time, the range controllers could see what was happening in live. And they would say, your shot's good, that's a kill. The aircraft would have to go, or they would say, you know, Tango 2-2, you're killed and we'd have to go. So then they built a range off the North Sea, off Lincolnshire. British Aerospace built that, and that was brilliant. Being in there with almost every aircraft I can think of, Mirages and, oh, I don't know, there was all sorts of people. We used to love to come and play there. Excuse me, I've got a bad chest still. that was the same system. Later on, using data link itself, then obviously all that became slightly redundant, and you could do it in cockpit. You would know that when you fired your missile, it would look at the parameters, the speed, the height, the range, the size of the target, and it would give you a kill or not. Can I show us your helmet? That's a bit rude, Matthew. Can I show us your helmet? You're a cheeky bugger. Which one? Let me have a look. I've got two. Stay with me. Don't tune out. There we go. That's number one. That's Mark IV, I think, my Remy serves me right, with the latest mask on, which I never liked. This mask has got wire, which runs up, and then you clip it on. They say it's better, but I never liked it. I preferred the earlier ones with like a chain, very, very, very tiny chain, and that was great. 43 squadron colours. That's an old navigator I flew with once, I think. So he died and I managed to get his head, which is very nice. Got my name on the back. And it was big. I mean, this weighs a ton. It was heavy. It wasn't particularly... I mean, it was very effective. But, of course, in combat, excuse me, I'm now fighting with it, fighting with a helmet like this on your head, if this weighs, say, I don't know, 7 pounds, half a stone, something like that, you then start pulling 6 or 7 G, then all of a sudden you've got 3.5 stone on your head or something to that sort of order. And I tell you what, my neck size went up when I went on fighters. I was a 15.5. When I left, I was a 17. That's no bullshit. That is true. Let me get the other one. That's even better. Ugh. You'll probably see that my room is a mess. I don't know I can get it. Come here, you. Sorry about that. Here we go. Right. This one I bought on eBay. You can see what it is. It's a Red Arrow helmet. You've got the Red Arrow squadron badge there on the front. You've got the arrow on the side. And this is an Alpha helmet. And the Alpha helmet is tremendous. I think we called it the Mark 10 for a while. But what this has got, which is special. Oh, there. That is Carl Fogarty's signature. Now, for those of you who don't know, Foggy was world champion motorcyclist for many years. He's famous. I mean, I love motorbikes. And when I saw it come up for sale, I thought, I got to have that. And I paid a bob or two for it, but don't worry about that. I could afford it at the time. I can't now, but I could at the time. And I've actually written to Carl and said, Carl, do you want your old helmet? And he's never written back, so stuff him. I've got it now. But this is the one he flew with the Arrows on a trip. I can't remember when. It was way back. I'll put that one down. And they gave him the helmet afterwards. Now, Carl, I think, was riding for Suzuki at the time, and he managed to do them a few favours, whatever that means, in terms of bits and pieces from... No, not Suzuki. What am I worried about? The Italian one. Oh, great. What's it called? The big Italian one. Ducati. That's it. And he did him some favours from the factory, and they were generous to him and his manager. So that's how I got. Those are my helmets, and I love them.
But before we move on, Keebs, like, did you ever fly with the MK10, or were you always on the MK4?
No. We have the 10s at the end, which is basically
okay.
What Alpha helmet is. Just going to say, yeah, the Alpha helmet is the civilian equivalent, just about. The Mark 10 was the RAF one, and mm-hmm. It was a very good helmet. It was lighter. It was more cutaway, which meant that you had a better view of things. And, it was an excellent helmet, excellent helmet. Right, so I've shown Matthew my helmet, which is that's as dirty as hell, yeah. I don't know what Rocky Lock's talking to. Which one? A lot. War is dirty, Rocky Lock. War is filthy. It's a horrible, horrible thing. And you've got to fight dirty. You know, I don't know if any of you have been in mischief or trouble, but if you hit someone, you've got to hit them hard and hit them once. Otherwise, you won't get another chance. And same as in combat. You've got to do things that he's not ready for or willing for. And, and that's the only way to fight. You know, if you don't want to fight like that, then you're in the wrong job. Right. Is there much difference, from Mike JF, between the F4K and the FGR2 in terms of acceleration? Do you know? I honestly don't know. The FGR2 with the Rolls-Royce engine was brilliant. I thought it was a very good engine. It was clean. It was, it was a good engine. I never flew the K with the American engines. They were smokier and dirtier. I honestly don't know. We'll have to look that one up. Right. Sorry about that, Mike JF. I can't answer that. Steve Ironmarsh. I watched the Tornado do a very slow, tight 360 around Leeming. It looks as tight as what an F-16 would do. Tornado was heavy, but how do they compare? Well, I flew the F-16, and the F-16, if you thought about turning, would turn. Simple as that. The Tornado, you had to heave it around. It had combat maneuver flaps and things like that. If it was light, then it would turn reasonably well. But it's turning circles. I can't remember the graphs now, but the F-16 was just a dream in terms of aerobatics. Closely followed by the Hawk. The Hawk was another brilliant turning aircraft. You know, you could pull your arms off and used to actually in the Hawk. If you pulled a lot of G at the end of a couple of combat sorties, the blood would all drain down to the crook of your elbow. And you'd end up with all the capillaries bursting in your elbows joint. And you'd have these hundreds of speckles. And first time I said, what's happened here? I've got a rash. He said, no, that's your blood bursting in your capillaries. And that was painful, very painful. No, one thing worse than that was the bends. I had the bends once in a PR9 at very high level. And trust me, that was excruciating. Anyway, another story. Do I still fly today? If so, no, I don't. I think I said last time, and I'm not being funny now, it's like playing for Manchester United or Liverpool or Arsenal or Tottenham or Bangor United, whatever your team is. When you get to the end of it, you have a choice. Do I want to go out and play for a pub team? Do I want to go out and play in America? Do I want to go to Japan or China and play? Or am I happy what I've done? I've had the best. I've enjoyed it. I've got no regrets. So I'll go and do something else. So I did something else. I joined the lifeboats amongst one thing, and then I went back and did a degree course for another. And then I started writing, and I love that. It's a second career, and that's where I'm happy. There are days like today, which was just a beautiful day. I would have loved to gone flying, no shadow about it. But I didn't want to go flying something, you know, that didn't give you a kick in the pants and a real whoosh. So I decided against it. I remember doing a ground tour in between my flying tours, And I can remember seeing a flight of Jaguars fly overhead, or Buccaneers, wherever it was, and I burst into tears. I thought, oh no, rotten bastards, I should be flying, not doing a groundwork. But that was one small emotional moment in 28 years, and I've got over that now. Right, have I flown helicopters? Yes, I did, funny enough. When I was an instructor on piston aircraft training ab initio students, I was coming up for end of tour, and I didn't know what they were going to offer me. I'd done Canberras, I'd done Chipmunks and Bulldogs, and I thought, will they offer me something decent? I don't know. Nobody was telling me, so I thought, I was on the helicopter base at Shawbury in Shropshire, which was the joint helicopter base, Army, Navy, Air Force, and we used to fly at the weekends and when it was quiet. Excuse me. And as Mike told you, there we go, he won't tell you. I went to see the boss of the helicopter unit. I said, any chance of some helicopter flying? He said, yeah, of course you can. So I did about 40 hours in the Gazelle, the Wessex, the Whirlwind, and we did all sorts of things. We did mountain flying, landing in woods and clearings, things like that. Yeah, and it was very rewarding. But he said to me afterwards, what do you think of it? I said, it's a bit like flying a lift horizontally. I said, it's very difficult to do a looping or anything like that, or a slow roll. So I said, to be perfectly honest, no, I'll stick with what do you call it? Wings. Those things at the side of an airplane, wings. And that's when I got my ground tour. So I should have gone in helicopters. But from the ground tour, I managed to get on to, did exactly the same when I was at the up at Lossiemouth on the Jaguar. The boss said, do you want some flying? I said, yeah, I'd already done about 30, 40 hours with in the back seat. And then we got some flying in the front seat and went solo with a Jag. Now, that was a good aircraft, surprisingly. That was not bad at combat. So, yeah, it's funny how life works out. Jude Mao said, I found it, Mike. Well, I'm glad he did. Right, the 88 Tench. Would mixed fighter force be as effective with today's aircraft they were with the Hawk Tornado combo as you described? No. The reason being, although I can't say that categorically, because the big advantage of today's aircraft is the technology and the way that they can talk to one another and see where one another is. Now, I don't know what the Hawk T2's got. I know it's a very clever airplane with some very fancy kit on board, but whether it could actually go with a Typhoon into combat or not, I honestly don't know. The other thing is these aircraft, they do like to fight and fly fast. So in other words, you don't really want to be below about 1.2 initially, because you're going to lose that speed as soon as you start turning. The Hawk, the T1s, they were coming into the fight, 400, which is not fast. But of course, if you've got a F-14 or an F-18 turning at 360, you know, in a tight spiral, then the Hawk's just going to nibble in. It's just like one of my Jack Russells chasing my Labrador, you know. You're going to get its tail eventually, and that's what they did. Right, John Ellis. The F-16 MLU birds could have stayed in service longer. Yes. Also, we've had that one, John Ellis, is that all these aircraft, I don't know what's wrong with sometimes the procurers. You know, they ask Lockheed or British Aerospace to design them a bomber or a fighter. And they go, right, yes, there it is. It's coming on. It costs you $22 billion or whatever it costs. And you can have it tomorrow and it'll do everything. It doesn't. They're just lying to you. They just want your money, your dollars or your pounds, wherever you're from. And they want to give it to the service. And hopefully the service will then do the dirty work and put it into service and iron the bugs out. Whereas F-16 and other aircraft, you know, you could. Wonderful, wonderful aircraft. Right. This is Adam Cotton. Was it common for former camera pilots to switch to air defense? No. Very uncommon. I was lucky. Because one of the things I was worried about when I was in training on pistons was being sent back to the camera as a camera instructor, which, no, to be perfectly honest, I didn't want to do that, which is why I considered helicopters as an alternative. Yeah, let's face it, air sea rescue or one of the green jobs, very rewarding job to give it. I mean, the job is more rewarding than the aircraft in some ways. So, no, I'm trying to think how many air Canberra pilots switched to air defence interceptors, or even bombers. A lot of the navigators in the early days switched to the backseat of Phantoms and later Tornadoes. I can't think of any of my mates who did the same. Most of them came from Lightnings or Hunters or things like that. But as I say, the one thing that helped me was I was able to go solo on the Jaguar. And from that, it gave me a lever. And I then went across and flew the Hunter on the tactical weapons course. And they were going to send me to the Jaguar as a pilot. But I wanted to go air defence, always had. And so I got that change, which was very nice of them. No, I was one of the few. But there were a lot of navigators who did the same. And I'm still in touch with some of them. So I didn't upset them that much. Did I ever train with the Wiggins? No. I was, 1 year was a really, really busy year. And we were away all the time. And to be honest, there were times where you just rarely saw your family. Now, I had three small kids and I had a responsibility. Now, thereby lies a tale, which I don't want to tell, but I will. And I came back from one detachment, don't know where it was, and the flight came on and said to me, "Phil, how are you fit for Monday going off to Sweden?" And I went, "Oh, come on, boss. You know, I've just got back after three, 6 weeks, something away, and I want to see my family." He said, "All right, then, I understand. Yeah, fair dues. Thanks a lot." And so I never went, which was a shame because I would have liked to have done. But, oh, yeah, I mean, we used to be away all the time sometimes. I mean, I was working out the other day. I have spent more time overseas in various places, with and without the airport, than I have living in Great Britain. Well, if you don't count Scotland as being part of Great Britain, you know, there we go. So, yeah, I've been away a lot. On Canberra's, I mean, I was on the squadron 18 months before I met everybody because people were all over the world doing various jobs. No, I didn't fly with the Wiggins. Hello, Phil from Caraco. Caraco? Dutch Caribbean? Oh, great. How wonderful. I tell you what, it's as warm here than it is in the Dutch Caribbean today. Could you mention some of your favourite air forces you're up against in terms of flying and tactical skills? If there was a big difference, yes. Why not? One of the things which the F-14-18 Tornado Hawk story came out was the Americans were very, very good at what they did. No doubt about it. They had the muscle, they had the men, they had the training. What they didn't have was necessarily the slightly more ingenious freedom of movement, which another term is for tactics, that we had. And we wouldn't break the rules. We would bend the rules to our advantage. And so if you put an American into a situation he was not familiar with, he wouldn't fly often as not. Later on, of course, they learned that maybe that's not such a good tactic. And I'm led to believe that some of them are now, you know, quite gung-ho. But if you take the Russians, for example, before that, the Russians were actually rigid. They were controlled from the ground and they were told what to do and when to do it, even to when to shoot. Now, you can't fight. Your hands are tied in that situation because it's such a flexible, four-dimensional chest that the brain being the fourth dimension, of course, is that you don't stand a chance against an enemy who's quick and agile and nimble and thinking on his feet and so on. So who did I like then? The Dutch. The Dutch were very much like us. Talking of Dutch Caribbean, the Dutch were a little bit more, well, whether it was something they were smoking or what, I don't know, but they were certainly a little bit wild at times. I've seen some wild stuff from the Dutch, and they like their combat, and they like to get tied in. I can remember one fight I got into. I can't remember what we were fighting, Dutch F-16s, German F-16s, Belgium F-16s. There was a big F-16 fight and a big pile of us Tornadoes with F-16s on our side as well. Now, that was mixed fighter force. I've forgotten that one. It was quite a furball. And this fight started and all the gloves were off. People were fighting one another. We were lucky. We knew it was an F-16. I'll have a go at it. Whereas we were quite unique. But we got this thing going and we were outside. We drifted into the Dusseldorf control zone. and we completely stopped flying there with this great cloud of NATO aircraft all whirling and skirmishing around. And when it was all over, we landed and we knew that it was trouble. And we went, "We're British, we don't understand. We're going home. We'll leave you to sort it out." And I think one or two of their guys got their knuckles wrapped for that. Right. Oh, thank you, Matthew L. You want to say that you're enjoying it. And yeah. Do you know, I hate speaking in public. If you ask me to speak in a dinner or something like afterwards, I'd be rubbish. But I do like this one. Northern Nightmare, hi. Hi, Northern Nightmare. Good name. Ian Cummings, did you ever fly the PR3 or PR7? My dad was on airframes in Lara. Yes, I did. I flew both. I flew the PR3 at the Canberra Conversion Unit. Oh, that was a lumbersome old beast, same as the B2 and the T4 to a lesser extent. And the PR7 was very nice, actually. I was posted to Lara, but never got there. I ended up in Malta on the PR9, which was fine. But the PR7 was very stable and solid blooming aircraft. It could fly reasonably high, 48, which is good in those days. Not much else could come up there, maybe apart from the odd lightning or some of the Mirages. And I like flying it. And I remember flying one back from Singapore with a passenger and my navigator. I thought, I'm going to fly all the way back to the UK with no autopilot, because the PR9 had hydraulic controls, it had autopilot, it had TACA and all sorts of things. Excuse me. And I got it up to height, trimmed it, and then sat there and played cards with my passenger. It flew itself. It was a great little airplane. Yeah, yeah, I loved it. I'm very capable. Went a long way. Good battery of cameras. Obviously, your dad serviced them well. And then, yeah, on the squadron in Witten, in Huntingdonshire, we had two types of aircraft. We had the PR9s, which was our day-to-day job, where we'd go off and do what we were ever looking at, mainly trying to find the IRA, actually. That was the thing that took up 90% of our time, plus the terrorists after the Baader-Meinhof and the Red Army faction and all that lot. We used to fly all over various places looking for bits and pieces. And but we had a lot of work to do, survey work, out in Borneo. So we took PR7s out there because you could fly with two navigators, which was easier for navigation. One would do it on the primitive nav controls in the back, and the other one would lie down the nose in the glass nose. Excuse me, can I have a drink? And one would lie down the glass nose map reading. And so we surveyed Borneo. Now that was a jungle, literally was a jungle. Great, great fun. Where else? I went to Kenya, did the survey of Kenya, Denmark, Britain, dozens of times. Friends of mine went out to Espíritu Santo out in the Fiji Way. They went out to the one I was on, which I got called back from because there was a war, wasn't there, in Guatemala and Honduras. I never made that one. They went out to the Grand Bahamas, and there were three of them out there, and I should have gone out the next day, and I didn't. The swine. They kept sending postcards saying, "Remember, great time, come and help." No, I've never forgiven them for that. Nice helmet, Phil. Thank you very much, Matthew. Well, that's cool. And Smedley do right. Yeah, they are cool, aren't they? Helmet's a good thing. You can buy them on eBay. I mean, they're not horrendously expensive, but you can buy them. Hey, anyway, I see the time is marching on. Can I play some guitars? No, I can't, Matthew. Well, I love my guitars. I collect guitars. I've got a few Fenders and things, especially like Fenders. No, not tonight. Locky Lock, was there any friction between pilot aircraft and particularly lively DACT? Yes. Oh, yes. It could get a bit heated in the debrief, and often you'd say, who won the fight? And you say, well, whoever wins the debrief. It would be whoever would shout the loudest and can remember the most details, which was fine until ACMI came along, and then it was all there on computer, which solved all that problem. But anything that was between you stopped at that point, except when you went to the bar and you'd had a few beers and certain discussions might flare up again, but obviously amiably. And often the fight, oh, my voice is going, often the fights or the arguments would be between the navigator and the pilot. When you say, why didn't you do that? I told you to, you know, reverse the turn. Or you go, because I didn't want to. I've got the stick and you can't have it. And so you get this argument. I've actually had one navigator unplugged his helmet on me because he couldn't talk to me anymore in the air because I wasn't doing what he wanted. Well, he was rubbish anyway. I don't mean that. He was probably a very nice guy and his mum loved him. Hello, Mr. Keeble. Thank you for being a pure gent of the skies. What was your best aircraft you flew? That's 903 Chris Holden. Chris, I assume that's your name, not 1903. That wasn't the year you were born, I hope. Hello, was somebody looking over my shoulder? It's my wife. Hang on. It's Mrs. Keeble. Oh, she was going to come in and talk to you if my cough started. Yes, I loved the Hunter. There we go. I'm just going to turn the camera. There you go. There she is. That's Mrs. Keeble. Been married 50 years, would you believe? Now, I need a medal for that. If that doesn't deserve a medal, then nothing does. The Hunter. The FGA-9 was just a dream to fly. Unbelievable. I loved it. It was a gentleman's fighter. If you were to buy one of your own and you couldn't find anything else, you could find almost anything and you wouldn't beat it. It was fast, it was slick, it turned, it carried a good weapons, guns, bombs, Sneb pods. You could put certain ones, the later models, you could put cameras in and all sorts. It was great at aeros. There was, and I'm going to hate myself for this comment, there were no navigators. Now, I love navigators. Some of my best friends are navigators. I wouldn't let my wife or my daughter mix with them, but they were great fun. And they often bought me beer, which was nice. And I'm still in touch with most of my ex-navigators. But the Hunter was on your own. It was quiet. You could, if you tuned in the radio compass, which I often used to do, was tune into Radio 4 and listen to the cricket from the Caribbean or somewhere while you were doing combat or something like that. Not very. If we'd crashed, they would have gone, what the hell was he doing? Listening to the cricket. But no, it was a lovely, lovely aeroplane, and that's my favourite. F-16 versus MiG-21. Well, I don't know. F-16... The MiG-21 was a bit of a barge, to be honest. Some of the later ones, you know, you're getting up to the 27s and 30s and all that lot, they were superb. But I think keep your eyes open over the next couple of days in Kashmir and you'll be seeing what's going on. You may even see similar aircraft types fighting one another. Who's better than who? That's an interesting situation. Which helicopter was the most manoeuvrable or memorable? The Wessex was nice. It was big and beefy, carried a lot, good solid engines, good auto stabs. But the Gazelle was nice. It was lively. It was like flying in your little, Caterham or something like that. Right. Thank you, Rob W. I agree. You know what I'm agreeing to, but I agree with him. Phil, what's your opinion? This is Adam Cotton. What's your opinion on the current RAF heavily civilized flying training system? And the frontline standardization of just two fast types, the Typhoon and the F-35. The Typhoon and the F-35 are superb, no doubt about it. But eggs in the baskets, that's what I'm going to say, is you need not a huge spread, but you need a bit of a spread in case something goes wrong, like all of a sudden, as with the Vulcan or the Buccaneer, fatigue. So you scrap those aircraft and you've got other aircraft to take on their roles, you know. I'm not a favour of RAF's heavily civilised flying training. I was always military. Because if something goes wrong, like the Falklands did, or the Gulf, or any other of those sort of things, you need people to do the job. It may not be the flying job, but you need people to run ops. You know, you need people on the ground. And the more military people you have in all trades, whether it's right up from the chef to the bottom air crew, then, you know, the more you've got who are in uniform, the more you can use them if things go wrong. I love the Typhoon. I think it's a brilliant aircraft. Never flown it. I'd love to have done, but I saw it being built when it had the early wing. It had a Concorde-shaped double reflex wing. They couldn't build it because it was too expensive. So they put the straight slab wing in, which is a shame. It would have been even better than it is with a decent wing. If I could fly anything today, what would it be? I've got people would like me to go out into space. I know that some of my navigators said I should have been an astrogator or something and not come back, but I've gone to the moon. What would I'd fly the F-15. But I was just thinking about something I was going through my brain. You know, at some point in the Air Force's history, we had a fabulous range of aircraft. We had the Harrier and the Sea Harrier. We had the Buccaneers. We had the Jaguars. We had the Phantoms. And later we had the GR4s and 1s. We had the PR9. We had the Hunters. Before that, you got things like the Vulcan and the Valiant and the Victor. And there's all the transport aircraft as well. We made wonderful, wonderful aeroplanes, which, you know, you couldn't hold light to. Even aircraft like the Cameron, going back to it for a minute, the Americans said, wow, this is great. And they went on and developed their own later marks, the RB-57F and the B-57G, bomber and recce. Wonderful blooming aircraft. We could have done that. In fact, they're still flying with NASA. They've still got them flying with NASA doing a lot of their training. So, yeah. Anyway, I've got to move on because we haven't got long. And Mike will take me off the air in a minute. And his question is, what do I think about the German Air Force? Very clever. I've just written, I'm going to talk about something now, another advert break, because we're going to go into the adverts now. This is my advert break. I've just written 4 novels. Well, I haven't finished them yet, but one's finished, one's nearly finished, and 2 I've got the framework for. And in one of them, I actually introduce a German navigator into the book because I rate them very highly. And the ones that flew the Tornado, of course, were as good as our guys. The Joint Services Training Center at Cottesmore for the Tornado, we had Italians and Germans and Brits, and they were exactly the same. And you only got to go back 60 years to see how good the Germans were on their own. And yeah, brilliant. In fact, I rate most of NATO, to be perfectly honest. The French were very good, apart from the fact they would stop flying about 1 o'clock and open up a bottle of rosé, which I could get quite used to. The Italians were the same. You go for lunch and you say to the Italians, what time do we start flying after lunch? They go, no, for you, the day is over. You go to the beach, you drink whatever that red stuff they drink, which is horrible. And I thought, well, yeah, that's lovely for a 2-week detachment, but that ain't preparing for war. But there you go. You've got to train for in peacetime the way you mean to go for war, and that's work hard. We used to get up and start flying at 8, and we'd be down from the first combat sortie by 8:45 before Woolworths or Tesco's were open up or whatever. And we would go on until night flying and do long, long, long weeks. And we would work bloody hard and train hard and really as well. Oh, Mr. Jansen, thank you for responding, Phil. You're more than welcome to visit our Caribbean island. And thanks for mentioning the Dutch. My pleasure, and I'm on my way. I'll just get my bags back. Don't tell the wife. I'll be there tomorrow. David Watson. Oh, yes, yes, long time. Yes, yes, that's a blast from the past. Off cameras. I'm just, my brain is now trying to go through all the photographs in there. And yes, David Watson. How you doing, mate? You all right? Good. Better than me, I hope. Oh, yeah, books, adverts. Right, the first 3 are a trilogy. If I bore you, turn off. It's about a couple of guys off the Phantom OCU get called down to the Falklands. The SALT talks between Reagan and Gorbachev, America and Russia, break down, and the Americans have to withdraw from Europe. And the RAF tried to fill the gap and send the OCU squadron, which it's a dual role, 64 Reserve Squadron, up to Iceland to fill the gap. Which actually, the SALT talks breaking down, another topical subject. These things just go around in circles, don't they? Amazing. Anyway, 64 go off to the Iceland and they get involved in a bit of a fracas over the Baltic with the Russians. Lots of fighting, lots of guys get shot down. And that features a German navigator and an Australian as well. I don't know how I put him in. Anyway, we've got to be fair to our Australian cousins. And that's a novel which will be coming out sometime this year, I hope. I'm just waiting for someone to do the cover for me. The second book is about the Tornado. There's a spy working at Wharton who's sending all the blueprints and plans to the Russians. Plus, he's also in charge of logistics, So we're scrapping certain parts, throwing them in the bin outside the factory, and they're going in a van over to the ferry and the continent, off to Russia, and they're rebuilding a copy of the Tornado. The only problem is that they've got a better radar than the British one. Now, that wouldn't be difficult. So the Brits go, you can't do that. You've got our bloody airplane. You've got a really good radar. And the Americans go, well, go and get it. So they send a crew in at night, and they basically They steal the Tornado and fly it back. Well, of course, they're not going to get away scot-free. They get chased by all sorts of bits and pieces, including the Spetsnavs when they land, and it goes on and on and on. It's a bit of fun, and it's something I enjoy. Third book is that's a sequel. Third book's a prequel, which is going back to the Falklands on 23 Squadron with the Phantoms, and it's about the Argentinian Navy who are licking their wounds after the South Atlantic War, and especially the fact that their aircraft carrier had to go into port and was never used in anguish. So they get the aircraft carrier all sort of spruced up, put decent steam catapults on, and if any authors are listening and copy this, I'm going to kill you. This is copyright. And they put Super 8 Tandards on. They practice somewhere off Antarctica, and then they then try to have a go at the Brits in the Falklands. We got information about that happening, so we send a group of F4s in to stop them doing that, and they get into a fight with the Argentinians again, and that was good fun. It goes on. I told Mike about it a little bit earlier. It doesn't end in glory, but it's a good book. Then the last book is a standalone book, which is about spy flying. It's about flying the camera into places. You see, a lot of the things that happened, I don't feel comfortable talking about wholly, because I don't know, I'm just old fashioned like that. I don't like talking about things that may or may not be sensitive. But what you can do in a book, you can write things, excuse me, that's Greg's cheese and steak sausage roll, which I had for tea, and it's coming up. You can write things that might have happened, which nobody knows. Did that happen? Didn't it happen? Did he do that? Didn't he do that? Is that real? Is that not real? Is that made up? And that's what I love about these books. I put real stories in, but you've got to spot what are real and what's made up. And that's part of the fun of it. And I can write all sorts of outrageous things, and some may be true, some may be not. RLL661. Do you think it was a mistake to go single crew aircraft like a Typhoon? In many ways, yes. An extra pair of eyes looking out the back is very handy from the Phantom of the Tornado. But you've got these things called defensive aid suites, DAS, which will sense if there's an aircraft there doing naughty things and will tell the computer what to do. The pilot, in some ways, doesn't have to fly. All he's doing is operating the computer, which, you know, dare I say it, a navigator could do, and you could fly it from the ground. So single crew aircraft, much fun as it is, I don't know, tricky one. That's a good question. In your opinion, what is the better air defence aircraft, 15, 18, 16? My opinion is the 15, although I could find 1,000 people disagree with me and say the 18, and likewise the 16, and even the 14. And even a lot of the MiGs. But for me, I love the 15. It's the complete aircraft. John Ellis, that's Northern Nightmare again. John Ellis, what would you want to strap? Would you want to strap into a Tornado today and go flying if you could? No, my lungs are shot to pieces. I couldn't, but I would love to. It would be a hoot, wouldn't it? You see these old boys from the World War II who go off flying in all sorts of things. And I think, good for you, mate. Whether it's in another Spitfire or a Phantom or a Tornado or whatever it is, good for you. Go and enjoy it. David Watson, he said, I had a wonderful time on 228 SAR. Hairy flying and the scrapes of the rotor tips caused a few choice remarks. I can well imagine. SAR, I think, is the pinnacle of helicopter flying. Well, no, that's not true, because I've got friends who are flying Chinooks out in Afghanistan, and that is very hairy. But it's very, very, very rewarding. As I said, I was with the lifeboats for 5 or 6 years, and that is hairy. But 228, and they would go out in weather that we wouldn't go out in sometimes, and you know, taking a crewman off a cargo ship in a force 10 gale or whatever it is. I've got my gale chart there. I only found it the other day. So yeah, and I mean, we went and did some mountain flying with the Wessex, and oh, scary. We got to march on. We're getting into the best part of this half. John Ellis, WB-57s were loaned to the USAF to host airborne data link. Oh, right. And used in combat recently. I didn't know that, John Ellis. Yes, airborne data link, BACN. Don't know what that is. And they've got boxes on them and they were used in combat. Yeah. And, of course, you've got all these modern stuff now, which when I watched the fly past at Buckingham Palace, you go, what the heck's that? And they've all got very clever gear on board and can tell people what's going on from the ground. But here are the days of flying over. I mean, are we all going to be doing it on drones in the future? And I noticed my old squad, my first squad in 39, are flying drones out of Waddington at the moment. Right. The 88 Tench, did you ever do DACT against the Lightning? Oh, yeah, many times. And how would you fight against it? Grief. How would you fight against the Lightning? Well, you couldn't go higher because the Lightning would eat your ass. You'd have to come in fast. The Lightning was equal in speed to the Tornado. You'd have to use your superior radar and your sky flash against what were fairly limited missiles, Red Top and Firestreak. And so you'd have to use your weapons to fight a Lightning. I wouldn't want to get too often into a close fight against one because they were good. And the pilots were blooming brilliant. As I say, the only reason I used to win occasionally in the camera was because you could outturn them, and if they were daft enough to turn against you, then they deserved it. Excuse me. Mike J.F., if you're able to answer, what is your opinion of the Shoreham incident? Oh, no, I can't talk about that one. The pilot was deemed as careless by the courts. Isn't that disrespect in a professional manner? Yes, you will find very few pilots are willing to criticise a fellow pilot without knowing all the facts, and you won't ever know all the facts. I honestly don't know. I've heard of the guy. I've not met him. I know him by reputation, and these guys are very good, but I don't know. I mean, if you look at one of my no, you don't follow me on Facebook, not my book page, but on my Facebook page, I actually put a picture of a pilot in an F-18 trying to do a low-level loop, and he used pancakes into the runway, which was scary. Scary. Now, if you can do that in F-18, you can do it in anything. But there we are. Oh, David Watson's retracted his message. I'm sorry about that. Ian Saxon, Keeves, have you and Dave Gledhill finished that book yet? Yes. Right, another plug. New book coming out July the 25th, I believe. The other reason I would say buy it from the publisher is because you'll get it before I do. I can remember, let me just do that. I can remember people writing to me saying, we've got a copy of your book. And I said, well, that's bloody rich because I haven't seen it yet. And I've lost my track. I was thinking of something completely different. We finished it. And if I dare say so, I love it. It's not heavy, but there's a lot of technical stuff in it. And what I've tried to do, Dave is the brains behind the unit. He's written a lot of wonderful books. I don't know if anybody's seen them. This is one of his books. Brilliant. You'll notice I've got a lot of them. He pays me to do this. So I've got quite a few of his books. I've got some more down there. There's another one. They're all very good books, very technical. And he's written others as well. My slant on it was to try and write something a little bit more easy to understand. I was never a brain box. And so in training, I would always try to not talk down to the students, but talk at their level. They could understand what I was talking about. I've come across so many instructors, especially weapons instructors, who are buggers for that, trying to talk up their subject. And as I put in a thing on the book website the other night, being a good instructor is making a difficult subject and making it easy to understand. And that's what I tried to do in this book. I put the pilot's point of view of somebody who's having a struggle And this is how I overcame it. Right from day one, right from the Chipmunk, right the way through the Jet Provost, the Gnat, the Canberra. Wasn't allowed to put too much on that because the book was running out. And then came back and talked about refreshing on the JP5, the Hawk, the Hunter, and then the OCU, and then to a squadron. And even when you finished on combat workup on a squadron, there was still tons of stuff to do, to learn and all that stuff. It was never ending. And then I became a fast jet instructor on the Phantom, later the Tornado. And I was still making mistakes and learning things to my cost. So, yeah, we have a publishing date. It's going to be produced. I think you'll enjoy it. I personally think £20 with free postage is a blooming good deal. I don't think I can match it for that. But, of course, you might want a signed copy and we'll have to come to some arrangement. Have I ever met a pilot or flown a plane from former Warsaw Pact? A Satin one came into Lucas when I was there. Can't remember what it was. It was like a meteor. It was like something out of the 50s. Shocking. It was quite a modern Russian airplane. And I sat in this thing and I thought, goodness gracious me, this has been knocked up at the back of someone's garage. And I thought, no wonder they have problems, but I think they've caught up now. Good spies, the Russians. I'm going to get shot for that. Phil, when mock combat flying, mock combat flying? No, it was deadly. Just that no one died. Against Luftwaffe pilots, was there any jingoist sense of refighting the air battles of World War II in the nicest sense, hard to resist? That's controversial, isn't it? No. Maybe in the bar afterwards, you know, you might slip the odd dig in, but no, in the air we'd be professional. And it was better man, better aircraft won. Be big about it. The people that didn't like losing, and might get a bit jingoistic with the Americans, if you shot an American down, which I did shoot an F-15 down on TLP, Tactical Leadership Program in Germany, and we looked at the two matching videos and timed them out as to which missile got to the enemy first, mine won. And no, they weren't happy. Because to them, it was a much bigger... See, in the Air Force, we're much more laid back. You know, if you lose, you've got to say to yourself, why have I lost? What am I doing losing? How do I get better? How do I improve myself? What do I do to make my next fight not lose? Whereas the Americans would take it awfully personally at times, and their mates would give them a hard time, or their boss would give them a hard time. Anyway, that's the Americans. Adam Cotton, do I self-publish? I'm going to, yes. My novels. Do I have a publisher? No, not yet. I've tried. Publishing a paperback or a novel is hard work. I've got friends. Dave Gledhill does an awful lot of self-publishing. I think he's written about 10 or maybe 1,000. I don't know. He churns them out. I read them first just to make sure that, you know, he's kosher. But no, I don't have a publisher. I'd like one. I've got a friend in France who's written very good. If ever you see a copy of Stolen Thunder by David Bogis, B-O-G-G-I-S, giving him a plug now, it's a really rattling good read for a civilian. And having produced that and a couple of others, one on the Hawk and one on something else, his publishers went, I don't want any more. And I thought, well, that's nonsense, because he was a good author. And he wrote about flying without too much experience. You know, Gavin Lyle's another one, if you like authors. Gavin Lyle's another one that I rate. Who else do I rate? I can't think anyway. Grant Rennie. That's like the film with Clint Eastwood in, lol. Oh, Operation Firefox, but with tornadoes. Are you accusing me? I have never read, John Ellis, Operation Firefox. I've heard about it vaguely, but I haven't read it. I've maybe seen clips of the film, but I haven't seen the film either. My stories all come out of this fevered brow. When I'm ill and I'm on antibiotics and my brain is mush. Actually, this is, I got into writing. You won't believe this. I was in a fever a couple of winters ago, and I spent most of Christmas, New Year in bed, and I was thinking and lying there. I thought, I've got a good story, a good line. I'll send it to Dave Gledhill. He'll bite my hand off. I wrote to him and said, Dave, listen, you can use this, mate, free gratis, build a book around it. I know whether he didn't like it, he was being polite, I don't know. He said, no, Phil, why don't you do it? And I thought, yeah, why don't I do it? And that's how I got into writing novels anyway. I had no intention of writing novels before. It's not copied from Firefox because I don't know what Firefox is. But I should assume that no story is really unique these days. Whatever you read, it's been done before by someone somewhere. I mean, when I was doing research for the book, The Tornado Out of Russia, there was all sorts of things that were going in the war. People were stealing all sorts of bits of foreign equipment and copying it. And anyway, there we go. Clint Eastwood. Yeah, he could play me in the next film. Yeah, why not? Yeah. I've just lost you. Grant Rennie. I have a relative that served 54 and a half years in the Navy. He was in the Falklands recently and retired behind a desk, which was, yes, 54 and a half years in the Navy. Good grief. How old would he have been? He would have been 70. He probably would join as a boy at 16. Good grief. Yeah, obviously, you can fly or sail a desk well beyond your normal retirement age. And a lot of my friends stayed on and did that sort of thing up way beyond what I wanted to do. No, I didn't want to fly truckies. I didn't want to fly helicopters. I'd had enough of piston aircraft. I always wanted to fly the sharp end stuff and nothing else. Buzz Aldrin, John Ellis, yes. Still gets to fly in an F-16 and go flying. Yeah. You can. Up until maybe 3 years ago, I was fit enough to do that. But my lungs, if I started pumping oxygen in at high pressure, my lungs would just give out. Grant Rennie, how did he manage 54 years? Special duties? No, John Ellis. I would think Grant Rennie's relative was a civilian flying that desk. He would have probably gone through to he was 60, 65 in the Navy, and then probably done the rest of it as a civil servant. As a civil servant, basically. Yeah, good. In at 15, you could do that. Yes, you could. Yeah, well done. David Watson, damn visitors this time. We'll have to watch the rest of you later. Grant, I'm running out. David, I'm running out of questions soon. I hope your visitors are kind to you. I've told my wife not to interfere or let anybody in. And my dogs have been very good. I've got a whole load of dogs in the house at the moment. 5 of mine and 2 of my sons. So I thought they'd come and see me, but they haven't. Where are we? Low-level RAF. Would you have liked to see the Tornado S3 fitted with a Meteor, BVR missile? Oh, yes, if it survived past 2011. Now you're talking. The Meteor missile and the Tornado, well, what a package. Yeah, because to be perfectly honest, you don't necessarily need a 12G fighter. I mean, you can, but if you're flying at Mach 2 or just below to save fuel, all you've got to do is punch off a missile and either A, keep flying through as bravely as you can. I know that nobody chases you, well, they can. Or turn around at 20 miles and go back for a cup of tea. And a bit like with the Phoenix, job done. The missile does the work these days. Frecklepunny, how much did tactics in the Tornado F3 change when they received AMRAAMs? Replacing the old... I don't know. I'd left them. I don't know. But I did do trials at Farnborough. I became a civilian for a short while. And I was on the OCU as a simulator instructor because I was waiting to see what I wanted to do with the rest of my life when I came out. And I got roped into a thing called Joust. Joust was a beyond visual range simulator. And the idea was they were going to link it up with Lucas, Leeming and Coningsby, and everybody was going to fly in real time against one another. Old technology, there was jitter and delay and all the rest of that. It never really was as good as it should have been. But I used to go to Farnborough for detachments to work with the boffins there. And they were looking at all this sort of stuff. And I must admit, from the figures and the results that I was involved in there, AMRAAM was damn special. Makes it so much easier. Hog Hog, you retracted your message. That's a shame. Grant Rennie, what do you think of reaction engines? You guys are asking me questions I know nothing about. Rolls-Royce, they were the last... bypass jet engines. British company building new Mach 5 engines for the new Concorde. Now, Concorde. You've put an E on the end. You shouldn't have done. We're British. We want Concorde without the E. The E, according to Michael Heseltine, I think it was, stands for England, which is a bit jingoistic, but there we are. Concorde, best aircraft, civilian, bar none. Superb. We used to try and kill Concorde when they were doing trials with it and couldn't get near it. Too high, too fast, too slick. Wonderful, wonderful airplane. And you can watch it all happening below with a gin and tonic in your hand. What more do you want? What a shame that took that out of production. And, of course, someone was bound to bring out a new aircraft built on the same lines. Very, very, very special, the Concorde. British again, of course. Hulk Hog, oh, you're back. Do you think that an existing airframe modified with state-of-the-art weapons would be a good alternative to huge cost developing a totally new aircraft? Well, when you look at how things have gone exponentially, yes, I think that sometimes you're better off with the state-of-the-art, fully developed state-of-the-art weapons and radar. None of your nonsense, you know, we'll do this over the next 5 years, nonsense. And it would be a jolly good move and save a lot of money. But you've got to remember, of course, that airframes don't last forever. Like old cars, you come and do an MOT on one day and somebody goes, "Boy, you notice this bit of rust here, mate, or this, you know, the wings are coming off or something," and eventually you have to replace them, whether you like it or not. Mike JF, any near misses or close to ejecting? Yes, 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 yes. I don't know where to begin on that one. Closest I came to ejecting was on an F3 doing a bit of an unauthorized trial flying it single engine. And we overshot the runway at Coningsby, and luckily we were in Lincolnshire, there were no hills. And I said to the guy in the front, who was a Canadian exchange pilot, "What I'm going to do is this." I didn't know how it worked. This was the flaps. I was going to muck around with the flaps. But before I could bring the flaps down to combat, they went all the way up and then to combat. I didn't know that. So I lost an awful lot of lift, sank like a stone, got very close to the ground. He was in the front, so he put one engine in reheat. What's the good engine? The one we were using. I put the one that was throttled back into reheat. Next thing you know, we're climbing away. Everything's looking tickety-boo. He thinks, "Oh, bloke in the back has got the idea." Closes his engine. I think, classic this is, I think the guy in the front's got the idea. Close my engine. We've got no power at all. And we start going down like a dingbat. Anyway, we put both engines in reheat, kept them there till we landed just about. Went to the squadron. I knew there was a medicinal bottle of whiskey. We had a couple of stiff whiskies. I said, "I'll debrief you tomorrow. Let's go to the bar and have a few beers." The guys in the bar went, "What the hell are you doing here? We thought you'd crashed." I said, "Yeah, I thought we crashed as well." A year or so later, I was playing golf, and there was a farmer there on the opposing team. And I was talking to him, and he said, "Do you know what, boy?" He said, I had this tornado come down into my field." And I thought, "Oh, good, scrap. I can sell that for millions." And I went, "Yes, I know who that was. That was me. And I nearly ploughed a furrow for you, save you doing it." That was hairy. And the big thing that we said to one another afterwards, when we came to the deep, we said, "Why didn't you eject?" And he said to me, "Why didn't I eject?" And I said, "I signed for it. It was my aircraft. I had to take it home." I said, "Why didn't you eject?" He said, "I thought you were in control." I said, "Neither of us was in control. It was a complete and utter rolling goat, you know." So, yeah, and there have been others as well, but nothing quite as bad as that. I'm trying to think now. There must be, but my brain has closed over them. Anyway, we're running out. We're running out of 6 minutes. Martin Strumpfer, how did you guys approach fighters like the F-15 in the F-3? Both have powerful radars and data link. Yes, they do. They do. And I must admit, the F-15 was a winner, generally. But again, you've just got to be that bit sneakier. So you get in unseen, or you get in with a bit of an advantage. That's all it needs, you know. Pretend you're running away, then don't. All sorts of little tricks, and just try to get the edge. And it only takes a tiny, tiny bit to get the edge on the other guy, and that's all you need. But in a straight one-on-one, gloves off, everyone obeying the rules, the F-15 is going to win. Ian Saxon, most prized possession kept from your squadron days. My helmet, I suppose, is one. I've got bits of tornado over there. You probably can't see them. Probably not worth don't think you're going to see them if I turn that around. I can't see what I've got. I've got a hand controller. Oh, that's right. I've got a Phantom hand controller and a Tornado hand controller, which is in a box down there somewhere because it's a blighter to fix up. I've got bits of Phantom. All sorts of things. I don't collect as much as I used to, but I certainly used to love collecting bits and pieces. Yeah, I think my hand controller, which is... Where's my hand controller? Oh, there it is. Hang on. There you go. One Phantom hand controller. Trigger, trim. I can't remember what they're all now. Nose wheel steering, all sorts of things on there. There it is. Picked it up, had it mounted, and sadly to say, I can't claim that it's one of mine. There's a fair chance it is, because I flew most Phantoms. And I've got a silver-plated one. The Israelis did one, silver-plated. Special edition, which is next door to impress the visitors, which I'm very proud of as well. It's about 5-6 scale. That was Ian Saxon. Grant Rennie, what I meant about Firefox was that he followed the Tornado scenario. Yes, it probably did. And I think whoever wrote it probably copied me, looking into the future. Adam Cotton. Phil, 50 years from now, when we're all gone, in your considered opinion, do you think there'll be manned fighters? No. I don't think in 50 years' time there will be manned fighters around. I think the days of manned fighters, sadly, are on the way out. Because technology is just so wonderful now. Why risk a man when... a box of computers and because it's not just that, you can put so much more into it because you've not got the cockpit with the avionics that the pilot needs, you haven't got the oxygen system, you haven't got all the other things. You can fill that with fuel, you can make the cockpit a lot smaller, which will reduce the drag. You can pull 12G if you want, and there's not going to be a bloke in there going, oh, for goodness sake, I'm going to die. So yeah, I think that 50 years from now, if we're all still here, then yeah, why not? There'll be all sorts of it. But trust me, looking back 50 years ago from now, I wouldn't have thought we'd got this far now. But so who knows what's going to be around. Self-tying boots, I don't know, hoverboards. Who knows? I could pinch some of those ideas. I think there were various things, Grant Rennie, being pinched from West Germany. Oh, there was. And that's what I talk about in my second book, that... a number of Russian aircraft. One dropped in to a lake in coming into Berlin, and it was in the English sector. And the Russians arrived and ringed off the lake and said to the Brits, you're not to go near it. And the Brits went, oh, well, you sure? He went, yeah, we will salvage it. Go away. When they pulled the aircraft, it was a MiG of some sort, 31. With a skip spin radar, I believe. When they pulled it up to the surface, the radar had gone. The boys had gone in underwater, stripped the thing of everything that was great, and took it back to Farnborough. Brilliant. And there were other things going on. They did the same with the guy that defected into Japan, stole all his stuff. The Russians were furious, but we got a better aircraft as a result. Tench 88. I believe the only NATO interceptor that could reach Concorde in a stern side inset was a Lightning F3. Ooh, that's provocative, isn't it? That's a hell of a statement. NATO interceptor. I think the F-15 could. Yeah, I'd go for the 15. Lightning F3. I flew an F5 in Singapore with a mate of mine on a ride. Wow, what a thrill that was. Brilliant. Anyway, we've got to come to the end now. Let me just get to the end. What would be great to sponsor a round of the world race between the Concorde and the SR-71? It would both reactivate in one last time. The great white European hope versus the dark American Challenger. Yeah, wouldn't that be fun? Have you met anybody from the Swedish Air Force? I've had a fat sug. No, I haven't. I discussed that I was sent to Sweden, but I couldn't go. And I regret that bitterly. I'd love to have gone. I think they're a great air force. They use the Sky Flash as well. They helped develop it as a missile. And I think they're technologically wizard. I will miss the Tornado. It retires next month. No love, Laurie. Won't we all? The GR4 was, I think, brilliant. I'm not saying the F3 wasn't good, but it wasn't, you know, do the job as well. I thought the GR4 was excellent. David Watson just popped in just to advise any young folk looking now to join the RAF as a pilot. They could do far worse than listening to your very enthusiastic voice, stories, and obviously surprise. That's one of the things that's in the new book, was about how to join, not the technical way of joining the Air Force with qualifications they joined, but the sort of attitude you need to join the RAF and get on, and how to get the most out of it. How about the hurdles and the hoops and the shit you have to put up with to get that far? And yeah, you're absolutely right, David Watson. Join the RAF if you can. If you can't be a pilot, there are lots of other jobs. You'll love every minute. You'll go to places overseas. You'll drink with your mates, and you will have a pride in doing a grand job. Right. John Ellis wants to start a GoFundMe and buy a surplus tornado. Oh, yeah. Yeah, we'll chip in for that. Ian Saxon, thanks, Keebs. Great banter as usual. Thanks, Mike. Mike, thanks for getting Phil on. Yeah, thanks, guys. You know you love it. The Iceman, were you ever able to take a clean Phantom jet and to max it? If so, did you ever do Mach 2? In a tornado, yes. The Phantom would have a struggle with getting up quite that fast because the engines, basically, they weren't purpose-built for that airframe, the intakes and things. And I remember we had a civilian aircraft overfly Britain where they'd all died of no oxygen, and it was very high. And the only aircraft that could get up to chase it was a clean F4. The ones with tanks couldn't get anywhere near there. I mean, you'd be lucky pushing over 30, you know, if you put tanks on. The Tornado would go Mach 2, and I certainly tried to. I got to 1.8 trying to go Mach 2 one night, and we had an emergency which scared the shit out of me. Right. Aircrew interview. If you like what we do, head over to www.patreon.com/aircrew interviews. It really does help us carry on and produce these videos. It does. Grant Rennie, thumbs up. Fatsug, thank you. I'm Swedish. I thought you were. Good luck to you. I can't speak any Swedish. Mike JF, 3 thumbs up. Oh, Mike. The Tench, thanks for all the Q&As. Really enjoyed it. And so on. Dashia. Really enjoyed it. Thank you. Adam Cotton, great, interesting. John Ellis, thanks, Mike. Thanks, Phil. Pleasure as always. Now, that might be it, Mike. Oh, yes, I do have a website. I nearly cancelled it this year.
Yes,
I don't have a login to tell me how many people looked at it. PhilipKeeble.com, all one word, apart from the .com bit. Or just look up Philip Keeble on Google. That'll send you to my website. You can see, I've got to find my web manager and get him to change it. He's so busy, he hasn't had a chance, which is why I didn't want to keep on the website anymore. But it's got the book I've got, a few clips. There's the F-18, F-3 story. There's a link to Dave Gledhill's website, which is even better. There's a little bit, which is a bit out of date, on the novels, but philipkeeble.com. And I'll try and update it when I get my web manager to come along and put some new stuff on.